corporate candy floss news and no political spin. This is Truth Radio by Internet. Thanks to our sponsor, NeemWell.com, because here, the expression is still free. Did George Bush Sr. help orchestrate the assassination of John F. Kennedy? We examine damning evidence that he did in this, our second discussion with historian and researcher John Hankey. You're on the next level.
Would you do me a favor and push me on to the next level?
And you're very welcome. This is Fintan Dunn reporting. Thank you for joining us. And thanks also to our sponsor, NeemWell.com, your personal source for potent Indian neem. It's only the world's most popular herb, thanks to 500 million people in India who use it as their primary health care. But hey, you won't hear that from Big Pharma, but you will hear it at NeemWell.com. Get the full details at NEEMWELL.com or just email Kathy McMahon at NeemWell.com. Now we're about to have part two of our discussion with John Hankey. If you missed part one, it's a devastating indictment of dark forces in the tragic plane crash which took the life of John Kennedy Jr. And you can check that out. It's on the homepage or in the archive of breakfornews.com. And we were summarizing there a video on the assassination of John Kennedy Jr., which was produced by historian and researcher into the JFK issues, both of them, John Hankey. He's an LA-based school teacher of history who's had a deep interest in these issues ever since he came across the Zapruder film back in the good old days. And he's been especially focused on all these issues since the assassination of John Kennedy Jr. because it felt to him like, hey, it was all happening again. And I do urge you to check out our first discussion. But we're going to turn our attention now to the movie JFK 2, The Bush Connection, also produced by John Hankey. And I think you should fasten your seatbelts on this one, because this definitely has implications for George Bush Sr., what we're about to discuss. And so let's waste no further time, because John Hankey is joining us on the line now from the West Coast. And John, you're very welcome again. Thanks for joining us once more, John. And maybe you could start so many places with this, but maybe just let's start with some of the connections between George Bush Sr. and old Tricky Dicky, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Hey.
The photographic evidence of that is particularly astonishing. According to Nixon's biography, I mean, and that's one of the great things about the video, and it's one of the great things about this whole issue, is how much of this information is put in, you can get out of the guy's own autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
But Nixon identifies Prescott Bush as one of the players. According to Nixon, he was, you know, he had just graduated from law school and was looking through the paper and saw an ad that had been placed by Prescott Bush and his group of powerful right-wing Republicans looking for candidates, and he applied to it, but he was a minion, I guess is the word that
mm-hmm.
I'm looking for, but he was an apprentice of Prescott Bush from the earliest days. The other thing that's really astonishing is this document that shows up, I'm trying to remember who wrote it, I believe it's signed by Richard Nixon, or in any case, it's signed by Nixon's staff. But Jack Ruby had been subpoenaed by one of the House committees investigating organized crime, that is the mafia. And this letter says that the committee is being asked to leave Jack Ruby out of their investigation because he is working directly for Congressman Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you have... he was in Dallas the day of the assassination. Well, that's no big deal, except that the FBI, well, this is what it says in the FBI files, that the FBI was questioning Marina Oswald, Oswald's widow, and she said that Oswald had been talking about shooting Nixon, and so the FBI calls Nixon up and says, have you ever been in Dallas? And Nixon says, no, and the FBI says, well, wait a minute, let us remind you then, you were in Dallas the day that President Kennedy was murdered, and Nixon says, oh yeah, that's right, I forgot. I was
that
in Dallas
time, today. Yeah.
And it's not at all clear what Nixon's role was in Dallas on the day that John Kennedy was murdered, other that he was there. He wasn't there at the moment that Kennedy was being shot. So whatever his job was on that day, it was a preparatory one. He wasn't part of the execution. And I don't, you know, it was a huge operation, the Kennedy assassination. There were various aspects of it. And Nixon was undoubtedly associated with one of those. I don't think he was associated with the shooters. I don't think that he had an association with E. Howard Hunt on that day. The question is who brought E. Howard Hunt into the White House? And what we find out is that E. Howard Hunt was he was one of the CIA officers who was present at the Bay of Pigs. He was very, very much involved in the Bay of Pigs, and lo and behold, George Bush Senior, who had been brought into Nixon's White House, was very much active in Nixon's White House, is the only person who has any sort of a demonstrable connection to Hunt. That is to say, nobody in the Nixon White House had any connection to CIA operations except George Bush. Now, of course, Bush claims that he didn't have any connection to CIA operations, but when you look at the circumstantial evidence, when you look at all of the flood of paperwork associated with where he was and what he was doing in 1963. Mm-hmm. He was very, very clearly involved in CIA operations in the Caribbean in preparation for the Bay of Pigs. And in fact, I understand that Fletcher Prouty, the Mr. X from the JFK movie, has identified Bush as one of the people that he had contact with as a CIA supervisor of the Bay of Pigs. But then you also have this memo written by J. Edgar Hoover identifying Bush likewise as a CIA supervisor of this group of anti-Castro terrorists, a group of people that Hoover refers to in the memo as misguided anti-Castro groups, quote-unquote.
Mm-hmm. And I've always felt as well that Richard Nixon was an errand boy when it came right down to it, and that Nixon was being jerked around in the whole Watergate thing, that there was an operation going on there, and that all of that was staged. It just smacks to me of a completely staged political controversy, like Monica Gate and like the recent Libby stuff. Political theatre that dark actors are arranging and that have very little to do with the principles involved. Would you agree?
Well, let's put it another way, and I think a little more directly. Nixon was assassinated, that is to say, Nixon's political career. Nixon was impeached as a CIA coup.
Yeah.
The Watergate break-in, which resulted in Nixon's impeachment, was planned and executed in order to be caught, in order to affect the destruction politically of Richard Nixon. Let me throw something in. It's, I think, fascinating reading Ehrlichman and Haldeman's books. They tell the story about how when Nixon came in, he was very, very fresh in office. He tells Ehrlichman that he wants the CIA files on the Bay of Pigs. Haldeman says that he responded to Nixon, you know, listen, let me look into the Kennedy assassination while we're at it. And Nixon says, no, don't worry about that, but I want the CIA files on the Bay of Pigs. And Haldeman goes on to say that he later came to the conclusion that when Nixon was saying that, when he said Bay of Pigs, he always meant Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Ehrlichman contacts the CIA. He talks to Richard Helms. He says that Nixon wants to get his hands on the CIA files on the Bay of Pigs. And Helms tells Ehrlichman no. And Ehrlichman says, wait a minute, this is the President of the United States. You can't say no to the President of the United States. And Ehrlichman is furious and goes in and tells Nixon, and Nixon says, tell Helms I want to talk to him. And Helms comes in, and they close the door, and they have a conversation, and Helms walks out, and Ehrlichman walks in, and Nixon says, forget about it. and Ehrlichman walks into Haldeman's office, because he can't yell at Nixon. He walks into Haldeman's office and starts blowing off all of the smoke and flames about how angry he is to find out that the U.S. government doesn't work the way that he thought it was, that the head of the CIA is not subject to the desires of the President of the United States, that there's somebody else is in charge, and it may not be the head of the CIA, but it certainly is not the President of the United States either, which makes the point that you were mentioning, that Nixon is a stooge. The Bushes are stooges. I mean, all of these guys have their strings pulled by the banking establishment, the CFR, if that's what you want to call them, or the Bilderbergs, if that's what you want to call them. But that, you know, there's a major worldwide class, sounds like Marx, but anyway, that, that there's a major banking worldwide establishment, and they make the decisions about what happens, and they decide what the CIA is going to do, and it is not the President of the United States by any means, and that the President serves at their pleasure, and when they are no longer pleased, that he's taken out. What happened is, the reason they took Nixon out is that Nixon decided, the way that Kennedy did, they had both had a very similar problem, which is they thought that they were president.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they were in charge. They thought that that meant something, and they didn't understand the situation. And Nixon, after living through 4 years, decided that he was going to do something about it. And he had his personal lawyer. They decided, right, they drew up the plan that in the second 4 years of Nixon's presidency, he was going to be in charge, and they were going to make the move. And he sent his personal lawyer around to a number of huge corporate entities and said, look, if you want to be on the right side of the winners, if you want to be on the friends list, you will put, and this, he's walked into the, for a specific example, he walked into the offices of the president of Eastern Airlines. Nixon's personal lawyer walks in with a suitcase and says, fill it up with $1 million in cash. Eastern Airlines was owned by the Rockefellers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go to the Godfather and demand $1 million in cash. You go in, you get down on your knees, and you kiss his ring or anything else that he wants you to kiss, and he gives you $1 million, and you understand that that's what the relationship is, right? That
mm-hmm.
you are a bought and paid for stooge. But Nixon tried to turn that around and to demand this money from people, and immediately after he was reelected, he declared, the word that he used was a revolution. He threw out all the CFR people. They were all in his cabinet, and he demoted all of them and said, look, there's now a super cabinet, and it's Ehrlichman and Haldeman. And if you want to talk to me, you talk to them, and they'll tell me what they think I need to know about it. But he cut himself off from all the Council on Foreign Relations people who have dominated every presidency since the Council on Foreign Relations was founded. And at the same time, the Watergate story, which had, you know, come out and been smothered when it originally came out before the election, after they got Nixon in and after they got Ford as their vice president, and after they got all their ducks lined up, well, then they took Nixon out.
Pretty much took him out. Well, he was in his second term, figured he had nothing to lose. So, yeah, that's an interesting light on Richard Nixon. And, of course, we have Hunt involved here through the Watergate thing. Hunt ends up in prison and starts threatening to talk. Of course, not that you'd believe anything that comes out of Hunt's mouth, but there you go. He did. And the indications were he was going to start talking about Bay of Pigs.
What he told the New York Times was that he was a CIA assassin. And that's what, for the, all of the many hundreds of people who were dedicated investigators of the truth of the Kennedy assassination. You know, you don't know the names of two CIA agents, or at least in 1963. You not only could you not name a member, not only could you not name an operative among the members, you couldn't, you surely couldn't name an assassin.
Yeah.
Here is Hunt sitting in jail announcing the fact that he was an assassin, that his Cubans, his fellow Cubans, he wasn't a Cuban, but his team of Cubans, I should say, who were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, were likewise assassins. And certainly it had been early on determined that, I mean, I remember sitting and listening to a guy named Donald Free talk about the Kennedy assassination and talk about Manuel Artime and the nest of assassins that the CIA had been using to try to assassinate Castro. And it was widely assumed that these guys would very likely have been the choice of the CIA to be used to assassinate Kennedy, right? I mean, it was a tool that people knew that the CIA had at hand. And so here is Hunt announcing that he is, right, four levels deep in the secrecy. He's announcing himself as not only a CIA member, not only as an operative, but as an assassin associated with this group of Cubans, so that for people in the Kennedy assassination investigative community, he was announcing that he was a Kennedy assassin, and that he was threatening to tell the story if Nixon, and at exactly the same moment that he's doing this, he's demanding $1 million in cash from Richard Nixon. And it was Nixon's efforts to raise that money, it was precisely Nixon's efforts to raise that money which was the source of the demands of assassination, that he was trying to obstruct justice. That further, the other, there's two things associated with the charge of obstruction of justice, which led to demands for his resignation from his own party members. And the first was his raising this money, the hush money for Hunt, and the second was his direction to the FBI Director Gray not to investigate E. Howard Hunt because it would, in Nixon's exact words, uncover the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And Ehrlichman, in his book, said that he thought that when Nixon said whole Bay of Pigs thing, that he was speaking of the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
They used Hunt to get Nixon to commit the acts that they were then going to use to bring him out of office.
Yeah. It sounds to me like they were smearing Hunt and the Kennedy assassination all over Nixon because they were going to turn him into a useful target, a misdirection going on there. But I wouldn't be surprised if Hunt played a role in misdirection operations because of what he recently said. Let's play a little of that audio of Hunt's so-called deathbed confession, which he gave at the time he was allegedly, he gave it because he was dying of cancer, but didn't get released until recently. But just let's have a listen to what Hunt said.
Let me point out at this point that if I had wanted to fictionalize what went on in Miami and elsewhere during the run-up for the big event, I would have done so. But I don't want any unreality to tinge this particular story, or the information, I should say. I was a bench warmer on it, and I had a reputation for honesty. I think it's essential to refocus on what this information that I've been providing you, and you alone, by the way, consists of. What is important in the story is that we've backtracked the chain of command up through Kornmeyer and laying the doings at the doorstep of LBJ. He, in my opinion, had an almost maniacal urge to become president. He regarded JFK as he was, in fact, an obstacle to achieving that. He could have waited for JFK to finish out his term and then undoubtedly a second term. So that would have put the LBJ at the head of a long list of people who were waiting for some change in the executive branch.
He's smearing LBJ now. I mean, I think he's doing an alert disinformation job, and you believe so too.
Certainly, that in fact he is the prince of disinformation. I mean, if somebody has a competitive example, I would be delighted to hear it. But, E. Howard Hunt admitted during his slander trial, I mean, he didn't admit it because he was trying to be forthcoming. He admitted it because he knew that the evidence was in the hands of the guy who was cross-examining him.
Mm-hmm.
But in cross-examination, he admitted the fact that he entered the National Archives and that he attempted to place forged memos into the National Archives, memos allegedly from Kennedy authorizing the assassination of President Diem. So he was trying to implicate Kennedy in murder, in fact, to show that Kennedy was guilty of the murder of the head of another country, and it was a lie.
Yeah.
He admitted as such. Well, so here we have again, right? He's trying to implicate a different president of a different murder of a different head of a different country. In this case, he's trying to implicate Johnson in the murder of John Kennedy. And, you know, I don't feel particularly inclined to get too adamant in defending Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was an American. He was a Southern American politician. I don't think that you can, in terms of circumstantial evidence, say anything more damning about an individual and the blackness of their heart and their willingness to commit all sorts of crimes than to say that they're a politician generally, but to say that they're a Southern politician is just extraordinary. If you know anything about the history of politics in the South, it's murder, mayhem, and stuffed ballot boxes at the very least.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too excited about trying to stand up for Johnson on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't know of any important evidence linking Johnson to the assassination, and I've only, you know, devoted my life to studying this. I think, in fact, that I also don't know of any solid evidence linking Johnson to the Eastern establishment, to the people who own NBC and CBS and the New York Times and the Washington Post, who did, you know, who carried the lion's share of the work involved in covering up the assassination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He doesn't have any links that I know of to the Central Intelligence Agency. He had a very, very close relationship with Hoover, but I don't think that the evidence is that J. Edgar Hoover was involved in any significant way in the Kennedy assassination. I think it's very plausible that Hoover knew about the assassination, but I think that it's likewise plausible that Hoover was the source of an FBI memo that went out to every FBI office saying that they had information that there was going to be an attempt on the president's life when he was in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody wrote that memo. Somebody got it into the system. I don't know that they could have done that without Hoover being cognizant of it. And I think that it, from my research, I think there's every reason to think that Hoover was the source of that memo, that he wrote it in order to cover his own butt. I think it's plausible that despite the fact that he wrote it, he also didn't take it into Kennedy's office and say, look, I think you need to know about this. I think he said, look, that's the Secret Service job, the Secret Service's job, not mine. And if the Secret Service is going to assassinate the president, that's not my responsibility. I don't supervise the Secret Service. It's not my responsibility to stop them. And in addition to which, there's considerable evidence that Hoover would have had, at the very least, mixed feelings about Kennedy's assassination. That is to say, there's reason to think that Hoover would have been happy about it. There's reason to think that Johnson would have been happy about it. I mean, Johnson is a Southern politician. He certainly is a mammoth of ambition and could not have cried very bitterly about the fact that Kennedy's death led to Johnson's presidency.
Yeah.
However, I don't know of any important substantive evidence showing a substantive connection between Hoover or Johnson and the assassination.
Yeah, and yet there's Hunt saying that it was LBJ's naked ambition that was at the core of the Kennedy assassination. So what is disappointing is when we start hearing that stuff pumped out on Coast to Coast on George Noory's show, and then when we find it also on Alex Jones, and a big deal being made out of Hunt's deathbed confession, etc., etc., getting us closer to the truth of the Kennedy assassination. Bullshit. My CIA fake alert.
George Bush.
Yeah.
And, you know, the connections between Hunt and George Bush are legion. And, you know, those are some that we should get into.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that Hunt knew very, very thoroughly. I think the evidence suggests that Hunt was answering directly to George Bush, that George Bush was his direct supervisor. In his deathbed confession, Hunt admits to having been involved peripherally in the assassination. He admits to having been in Dallas. He admits that his very closest associate, Frank Sturgis, was also in Dallas and was also involved. But for him to leave George Bush out is to tell you that what he is saying, therefore, is some kind of an operation, that he's giving you, you know, he's baiting his hook with little pieces of the truth about his own involvement, which is very well known and doesn't need his deathbed confession to make the point. He's giving you another little piece of truth as bait about Sturgis's involvement, which is very well known and doesn't need his deathbed confession to establish it.
Yep.
He's baiting his hook with that in order to give you the lie that Johnson was in some kind of way substantively involved in the perpetration of the assassination, and which overall makes me think as the strongest evidence for that Johnson was not involved in any substantive way. I mean, the fact that I don't know of any evidence that Johnson was involved doesn't mean that there wasn't some, but I'm not aware of it. And now we have Hunt's testimony. Well, to me, Hunt's deathbed so-called confession is now a fairly substantive piece of evidence that Johnson was not involved. If Hunt said that he was, I think that that means that he wasn't.
Yeah, and as you point out as well, John, it's the fact that he's pointing the finger at LBJ while at the same time not mentioning George Bush, that in reverse is another vital piece of evidence as to what's really going on here. But let's take a break for music for a moment and we'll pick it up again. We're getting clear evidence, folks, of the involvement of George Bush Sr. in the events of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And after this piece of music, which is a bright idea from Orson, we'll take a look at the role of Hoover in all this. And with John Hankey, we're discussing JFK, You're on the Next Level. And we'll be right back.
Somebody tell you what I couldn't tell you. I hope they did. Will I learn to regret it, or should I forget it? Whatever this is, it feels electric. You shot me a sweet look, gave me a yearbook, told me to sign, it was a signal. But I couldn't find the words, I just couldn't find the nerve. As usual, oh, here's my bright idea. Up for you. An army of managers and lots of pretty boys lining up to meet with you. Oh, I'm pretty sure that it was you that I bumped into just the other day at the record store. But I still don't have a clue. I just couldn't talk to you as you.
You're very welcome back. You're on the Next Level on breakfornews.com and with John Hankey, and we're continuing our discussion of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. John, let's as well just tie down for people where Hoover was coming from in all this, because Hoover, at an essential level, Hoover cannot be working with the Bushes, because it's Hoover who goes after Prescott Bush and Union Bank.
Well, one of the things about it is that Hoover is like Johnson. He's not Eastern establishment. Hoover was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth like Johnson. He didn't go to Yale. He was not a member of Skull and Bones. He doesn't have any bankers as uncles or genocidal architects anywhere in his family. He does not run in that circle of people. Mm-hmm. And as you say, in 1943, Union Bank of New York was seized as a U.S. government, I'm sorry, as a Nazi asset. It was seized as a result of an investigation that was spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, and the chief executive officer of that bank was Prescott Bush. Mm-hmm. which makes him, well, and, you know, I make the point in the video, I'm not sure what version you have. The latest version is a little bit sharper on this point. I make the point that, you know, Prescott Bush's uncle, George Herbert Walker, was a very, very wealthy and powerful individual, that Prescott could have gotten jobs with lots and lots of places. He didn't have to work for the Nazis. He could have, if he was going to work with German financiers, there were lots and lots of German financiers that he could have worked with. He worked with Fritz Thyssen, the main financier. Well, he was the main publicly acknowledged financier of Adolf Hitler. If we were going to go, you know, spend an hour on that particular topic, I would suggest that, in fact, it was Harriman and the Rockefellers and perhaps the Rothschilds, but that Thyssen was taking the fall. And there's lots of circumstantial evidence to suggest that Thyssen's support of Hitler was that he published it in order to distract people from the reality that Hitler was, in fact, mainly financed from outside. But never mind. Let's set that aside. Thyssen is the main publicly acknowledged financier of Hitler during his earliest days, and Prescott chooses to work with the leading Nazis, therefore, in the financial realm, absolutely the leading Nazi is whom he chooses to associate himself with. Let me make another point, which is that in doing that, Prescott, and I think the Bushes generally, as we were discussing with Nixon, are mere stooges. He was the chief executive officer. He owned one share of Union Bank. Averell Harriman owned 3,999 shares.
Right.
And Thyssen owned a similar amount, but so that he was, Prescott and the Bushes were worth 1/8,000th of the resources that were involved in this thing. I think that there is a tendency of people to talk about George Bush Sr. and the Carlyle Group and Halliburton, and to get worked up about the financial significance of the Bushes and their operations.
Yeah.
Any of this stuff, that's all chimera, that's all show, that's all disinformation, really, that they're the highest ranking of the stooges, I suppose, but they are certainly nothing more than that. They are hirelings. They serve at the whim of these guys who are 4,000 times more financially capable.
Yeah, let's pick up on one of them there, which is Harriman.
I don't consider myself a particularly good researcher, but I do like history. And so I'm tooling along and I'm reading this book. Mark Lane, who I consider a fabulous researcher, wrote a book called Plausible Denial about this trial that he was involved in. We should talk about that in some detail, but in any case, in the trial, Hunt is up on the stand, and the words come out of his mouth that at the end of World War I, he was working directly for Averell Harriman as his press secretary, that he was in daily contact with Averell Harriman. I don't know of anybody besides Hunt who was in daily contact with Averell Harriman other than Prescott Bush, who was Harriman's first lieutenant
right. In
his financial dealings, in Brown Brothers Harriman. And Harriman is generally regarded as a figure of liberal democracy.
Right.
And it's just such a fraud. He was a stone Nazi. He was a founding mover of the Nazi Party. Well, we have to look at that again, because we find out that, well, the Nazi Harriman wasn't German, and the Nazi Party we are led to believe was German. And I don't think that the Nazi Party was essentially a German operation. I think that it was mainly funded by outside interests. But that isn't where we wanted to go. And my approach to history is that I always find the most important stuff in a place that I wasn't looking for it, so that I don't trust my instincts about where to look, and I try to take just a shotgun approach and try to learn about everything.
Mm-hmm.
You find out that Kennedy did not approve the Bay of Pigs invasion, that the CIA, Richard Helms, came to him, and they told him the proposal for the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he said no. Those were his exact words, right? It wasn't a maybe, it was a no. He said he didn't want a D-Day-style invasion. The CIA went ahead with it. Dulles went ahead with it, and Kennedy fired Dulles, and he fired Bissell, and he fired General Cabell, all three of whom are tied to the assassination. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the point is that he learned at that point to distrust entirely the military and the CIA. And so during the missile crisis, he had these guys telling him that he should attack Cuba because the missiles were not ready. They weren't ready to launch. That if they hit them now, before the missiles were in place and set up and operational, that they could do this thing. Well, it comes out 40 years later that the missiles were in place and that they were armed. And anyway, his aides are saying, his military aides and CIA people are saying, go ahead and do this, and we'll all go to a bunker, and then we'll launch an invasion. And Kennedy says, no. You guys are going to sit here in this room. If this thing breaks out into nuclear war, you're going to be the first casualties. Now let's take another look. Now that you know that you're going to be the first to die in this thing if it goes wrong, mm-hmm. let's see if you have a different approach as to how we should solve this. And he managed to, on his right, on his own and against the advice of all of his advisors, get us out of this thing without resulting in a full-scale thermal nuclear exchange. So that I think that we owe Kennedy a real commitment to investigate this thing. And I think that 9/11 is the most important issue, but I think that there are very, very important lessons to be learned about 9/11 by studying the Kennedy assassination. And I'll give you one very good example, which is that Alan Dulles is generally regarded as the architect of the Kennedy assassination. Certainly he is the only person who was in a position to operate such a huge operation that involved the FBI, that is to say CIA elements in the FBI, that involved the Secret Service, and I should say CIA elements in the Secret Service, that involved CIA elements in the CIA, and that also was this, you know, used a Wurlitzer, is I think the word that he used, the media Wurlitzer, to pump out their official version. Mm-hmm. And of course they put him in charge of the investigation, in charge of the Warren Commission. He was the chief investigative officer of the Warren Commission. Well, on 9/11, when they were finally forced to appoint a commission to investigate 9/11, the Bushes wanted to put Henry Kissinger in charge. And I think that does a very, very good job of telling you who the architect of 9/11 was. But
yeah,
let's roll on. One of the things I'm proudest about of the video is that I think it takes about 15 minutes to just destroy all suggestion that Kennedy's murder was anything but a very, very widespread plot involving the most powerful elements of the country. It presents 100%. You see the witnesses standing in front of the grassy knoll ducking. You see the police officers. They're firing shots from the grassy knoll. 100 people went charging up the grassy knoll to try to apprehend the shooter. It's just astonishing. You know, in New York City, the witnesses run away from the scene of a crime. These people are charging into a place that they know bullets have been fired from.
Yeah.
But you see all of this on the video. 100% of the Dallas doctors are presented in the emergency room, are presented saying that Kennedy had a large exit wound in the back of his head, that he had a throat wound in his throat. His press secretary indicates that the entrance wound of the shot that killed him hit him in the right temple, near his, just in back of his eye. The New York Times published the interviews with the doctors that contained all of that information. Entrance wounds on the throat, an entrance wound on the right side of his head, and a large, the words of the New York Times, massive gaping exit wound in the back of the head. And of course, there's the Zapruder film. In the video, you see that the Secret Service utterly abandoned their duty. One of the most striking pieces of footage is the Secret Service guy trying to climb onto the back of the limousine, trying to accompany Kennedy's vehicle, and his supervisor waves him away from Kennedy's vehicle. He would normally have ridden on the back, and the supervisor waves him away, and the guy stops and shrugs his shoulders and raises his hands as if to say, what the hell? So you have this dramatic video footage of the stand down by the Secret Service.
It's awesome to watch that guy stand there, and he lifts his hands out horizontal to the ground at both sides of his body. He's saying, what the fuck? I mean, okay. I'm getting off the guardrail, for crying out loud. This is where I'm supposed to be. But okay.
Right. Well, and you have Fletcher Prouty, who served in this capacity of supplementing the Secret Service to protecting the president. He's intimately familiar. He participated in it, saying that, you know, in a situation like Dealey Plaza, where you have this turn and the president's car has to slow down, the Secret Service regulations specifically say that you have to pour on the security, and then you have Blakey, the chief counsel of the House investigation, saying that there were, instead of pouring on the protection, there were not a handful, which would have been vastly insufficient, there were no Secret Service agents in that area. But to me, the really key issue and is the proof that the body was stolen and carved up, that shortly after the president died, the Secret Service illegally snatched the body, took it away from the individual who, according to law, should have been in charge of the autopsy, loaded it on a plane, flew it into a military hospital. But on the way, apparently, and the body disappeared, and the wounds, the entrance wounds on the front, were carved up and were attempted to make look like...
collateral damage.
Well,
yeah.
I'm sorry?
They try to make it look like collateral damage rather than entry wounds on the front of the body.
Right.
Yeah.
The president has just been shot. The FBI and the CIA are going to be on the absolutely highest alert. And under those circumstances, somebody managed to steal the president's body and carve on it. Well, so being able to substantiate that that happened or didn't is an extraordinarily important point. Well, what do we have as evidence? We have a memo written by FBI agents at the autopsy who saw the body roll in and then wrote the memo saying somebody's been carving on this body. Well, that's pretty powerful evidence. I mean, however, they could be mistaken. But we then have on video, one of the Dallas doctors was brought in and was allowed to examine the photos that were taken of the president's body before the autopsy started. And the question that he was directed to answer was, do the wounds look to you as they did look to you in Dallas, or has somebody been cutting on the president's head? And the guy very, very, very distinctly points to the entrance wound on the side on Kennedy's temple and says that somebody has been cutting on that. All right, there's no mincing of words, there's mm-hmm. no shades of gray, he's very, very plainly spoken that someone has taken a knife and cut the skin and then ripped it back in order to expose the bone, is his precise words. And then, in case, you know, there's any doubt, there's a photograph of that wound. And when you look at it, it doesn't look like anything more than it looks like someone has taken out a knife and very, very crudely cut into Kennedy's skin and then pulled the skin back. It doesn't mm-hmm. look like an exit wound, but it does look, I suppose, as something that someone who was extremely amateur and was trying to, you know, to do his best. I mean, I have to admit, I hesitate a little bit to criticize these individuals because Kennedy had this huge exit wound in the back of his head. What were they supposed to do? The point is that you have very, very, very case closed. You couldn't ask for three more positive pieces of evidence, and one of them would be positive, and you have three of them that demonstrate that there was complicity in Kennedy's assassination at the very, very, very highest levels. The inescapable conclusion is that the people who committed this crime were accessories before the fact, that they were part of the conspiracy to murder. And as we will see, the Bushes are very, very much involved in this. And
yeah, right.
A very, very good place to start in investigating this thing is the establishment of the fact that the Bushes are a Nazi family. They were slave owners. Right, the Bush family are descended from slave owners. The next point is to establish that Hunt was an assassin and then to look at Hunt's connections to this band of Nazis. The most important piece of evidence linking Hunt to the assassination is a memo that was written by Richard Helms to Jesus Angleton, his number one, his first lieutenant, saying that E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas, that he was part of an assassination team and that he was involved in the assassination. The reason this memo was written was because what the memo says, the reason for it having been written, is that they anticipated that the congressional investigations were going to uncover the fact that Hunt was involved in the assassination, and they were discussing how shall we deal with this, mm-hmm. and they said, well, we'll just say that Hunt's a loose cannon, you know, we'll hang him out. He's going to go down. We're not going to worry about it. And I think they didn't realize that Hunt was connected to the Bushes and that the Bushes were going to be able to shut that whole thing down. And sure enough, they fire the head of the CIA, who was cooperating with the congressional investigation, Colby, was fired and he was replaced by Bush. And Bush stopped the investigation, he stopped the cooperation, and he started investigations of all of the senators and congressmen who were involved in the investigation in order to make sure that they shut up.
Exactly.
In any case, somebody on the committee, it could have been one of the senators or congressmen, and it could have been one of the staff, but somebody got this CIA memo naming Hunt as an assassin and leaked it to the press. They probably leaked it to Time and Newsweek and the New York Times and the LA Times and on and on and on. Of course, none of those magazines or newspapers published anything about it, but a little New Jersey newspaper published an article about it, and Spotlight Magazine published an article about it. And Hunt, after Bush became the head of the CIA and was shutting all this stuff down, Hunt starts to feel his oats, right? I mean, a minute ago, the head of the CIA was going to hand him over. Now he's feeling so secure in his position that he sues Spotlight Magazine for slander. The jury listened to the evidence. They were not able to see the actual memo written by Helms and to Angleton. However, they were able to hear all of the circumstantial evidence involved, and they found that Hunt was indeed involved in the assassination to the extent that they found the magazine innocent of slander, right? I mean, the article published by Spotlight said that Hunt was an assassin, that he was in Dallas, that he was involved in the assassination. In order to find the magazine innocent, they had to find that the majority of the evidence, the preponderance of the evidence, indicated that Hunt was guilty, and that's what they found. There are a number of reasons that they found that, one of which is that Hunt had, in the past, offered four different explanations of where he was the day that Kennedy was murdered. All of them were proved to be lies. On the stand, he claimed that he was spending the time, he spent the day with his family. And the lawyer doing the cross-examination, on cross-examination says, well, now wait a minute, in the complaint you said that the reason that you're suing is because your family now wonders whether or not you were involved in the assassination, and your relationship with them is with your children has been harmed because of this allegation that you were involved in the assassination, but you're telling us that your family was with you. How can they have doubts about where you were if you were with them? Apparently you weren't with them, as you said. Anyway, so they destroyed five different explanations of Hunt had about where he was. Like Nixon, Hunt can't explain where he was on the day of the assassination. It's interesting to note that, like Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush Sr., he can't explain where he was on the day of the assassination. The other really powerful piece of evidence is the testimony of Marita Lorenz, who was acknowledged by Helms on the stand. Helms acknowledged, the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, acknowledged that Marita Lorenz was a CIA agent, that she was involved in their Operation 40, which was this misguided anti-Castro group. She talks about how she piled in the car with her fellow terrorists, and they drove to Dallas in two cars filled with weapons. They went to a hotel room. They sat there for a while. Lee Harvey Oswald was present. Jack Ruby was present, and E. Howard Hunt came walking in and began passing out maps and money. She determined that this was not going to be a raid on Cuba. It was not what she signed up for. It was not her intention of carrying out raids in the United States upon American citizens. She left, flew home, and the president died the next day. And Sturgis, Frank Sturgis, a very close associate of hers who was in the room, came back a couple of days later and said, you should have been there. We made history. We killed the president. Having established then what the jury found to be overwhelming evidence of Hunt's involvement in the murder of the president is Bush's connections to Hunt. I discussed the fact that on the stand, Hunt said that he was, that immediately at the end of World War II, when the CIA was just being begun, Hunt was Averell Harriman's press secretary, and he met with Harriman on a daily basis, which would have, it seems, unavoidably put him into contact and communication with Prescott Bush, who was Averell Harriman's first lieutenant, his closest business associate. In any case, during Watergate, Hunt and Bush come into the White House at exactly the same time. Hunt got arrested after the Watergate break-in. He's demanding that Nixon pay him $1 million in hush money. And the money that he was paid $1 million, and the money came from Bush's closest business associate, a guy named Leitke. Leitke and Bush together founded Zapata Oil, and then after it was established and apparently legitimate, Leitke was an oil man, and it took Leitke's reputation and name to make Zapata a legitimate oil company, because, you know, nobody had ever heard of George Bush. When they were ready to go, when the CIA was ready to begin the very, very practical preparations for the invasion of the Bay of Pigs, Leitke gave Zapata offshore to Bush, made him the sole owner. And this is the guy. His closest business associate is writing the checks to Hunt for his hush money. Hunt, on the stand, said that he was a supervisor of the Bay of Pigs, and this memo, well, there's a huge amount of evidence indicating that Bush was the next level of supervisor, that he would have been Hunt's direct supervisor at the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. The major piece of evidence is the memo written by J. Edgar Hoover 5 days after the assassination. The title of the memo is Assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. In the memo, Hoover doesn't say anything about the assassination, right? He gives it that title, and then he starts talking about what he calls, his exact words, misguided anti-Castro groups. He doesn't explain in the memo that why he has linked these two, but clearly he has linked these misguided anti-Castro groups. He says that they did an investigation of these misguided groups and that they then wanted to give their report to the responsible parties at the Central Intelligence Agency, and they called them in to give them the report, the responsible parties, and he names George Bush, Mr. George Bush, as the CIA officer who came to receive this report, which says two things. One, it says that Bush was in the CIA at this time, and the other is that it establishes him as a supervisor of the anti-Castro Cubans. Bush says that it wasn't him. He was questioned about it when the memo was first discovered. Bush was questioned about it, and he said, oh, it must have been another George Bush, and there's been extensive investigations to determine. Well, in fact, the CIA did bother to go out and find somebody else named George Bush so that in case anything like this were to come up, Bush could say, oh, it was somebody else. However, The Nation magazine interviewed the other George Bush, and he said, you know, he was a very, very low-level technician, that he certainly never had any contacts with anybody at the FBI to discuss anything, and certainly he had nothing to do with Cuba at all. He was an analyst. I think he analyzed maps.
Yeah, he was a pretty low-level coast and landing beach analyst. I don't think that's the kind of guy that Hoover would have been giving briefings about JFK's assassination to. No, so clearly, when there's a George Bush being mentioned in relation to all these, it's the George Bush. You'll get details on this in the forum on breakfornews.com. The story, if you click on the photo of John Hankey that goes with this interview, you'll get to the forum post for this audio, and you can get links to all of that good stuff. We've got some good stuff on the Bushes in the forum. But George Bush said, I was in Houston, Texas at the time and involved in the independent oil drilling business. And I was running for Senate in late 63. I don't have any idea what he's talking about. Must be another George Bush. Okay, folks, let's take a little break and we'll pick things up the other side of some more music, perhaps with some of the Skull and Bones angles, which take us back into the CIA again. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com. I'm with John Hankey, and we'll be right back.
Spending all of the nights just a-laughing.
And you're very welcome back. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com. I'm with John Hankey. And we're going to discuss some Skull and Bones issues. But hey, just to whet your appetite, here's George Bush Jr. and John Kerry being questioned, if you want to call it that, by the mainstream media about them both being in Skull and Bones just prior to the 2004 election. When I say questioned, I mean that the media are laughing along with Bush and Kerry at the notion that this might be in any way remotely relevant. Here goes.
You were both in Skull and Bones, the secret society.
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
The conspiracy theorists are going to go
wild. I'm sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the website.
Number 322.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
It's a secret. Yeah, you bet. Well, John, maybe you'd pick the story up there in connection with George Bush Sr. And
Bush was in Skull and Bones, which in itself connects him to the CIA. Because the architect of the CIA was in Skull and Bones. Averill Harriman, who was deeply involved in the CIA, was in Skull and Bones. The F. Truby Davison, who was the head of hiring for the CIA, was in Skull and Bones. But his F. Truby Davison's son, Endicott, was in Skull and Bones the year that George Bush was in Skull and Bones, so that George Bush is a brother under the skin to the head of hiring for CIA. Well, you know, all right, so this is a connection to the CIA, but it doesn't prove anything. However, when Bush left college, when he left Skull and Bones, he went to work for a guy named Neil Mallon. Well, Neil Mallon has been identified as a recruiter by the CIA, and I just love this. He was identified as a recruiter, exact words, as a recruiter for the CIA by Prescott Bush himself. In a letter, Bush says, oh, yes, he does this wonderful work for the CIA recruiting people. To work in that important agency. I believe those are his exact words.
Right.
The point is that Bush went from being a brother under the skin to the head of hiring to working for a CIA recruiter, and when he was done, he set up Zapata Offshore, which was right dab in the middle of CIA operations in the Caribbean in preparation for the Bay of Pigs, and just in case there was any doubt about it, there's another letter from this one from Neil Mallon, describing a meeting that he is setting up between himself and Prescott Bush with the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, to discuss their mutual interests in the Caribbean. Well, if anybody can suggest what the mutual interests of these guys are, other than the fact that Prescott's son is going to be supervising those operations of the CIA in the Caribbean, I'd be interested to hear speculation that is other than that one. I mean, that's the very obvious one. But the point is that you have this overwhelming mountain of circumstantial evidence that's backing up and giving substance and context to the Hoover memo, very clearly indicating that Bush was a supervisor of these CIA assassins who were in Dealey Plaza, who were identified by Richard Helms as having been involved in the assassination. I don't know that you could ask for much more clear evidence than that of Bush's involvement in the assassination.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty clear at this stage that the George Bush that is being referred to in these memos is the George Bush. It's not some other George Bush, and therefore we know who we're talking about now when the George Bush name comes up. And I think one of the most powerful pieces of analysis you've done in the video is where you show the background to what Hoover wrote, that Hoover was essentially writing in code, and that there was a very good reason why a George Bush was showing up to see what Hoover was going to say about all this assassination stuff that had just taken place days before.
Well, I'm not sure that Hoover would have anticipated who was going to come walking through the door when he said that he wanted to give a report. He wanted the responsible parties from the CIA in charge of these anti-Castro groups. When he said that he wanted that person to show up so that he could give them his report, I'm not sure that he would have, and perhaps he did have the FBI, I'm sorry, have the CIA so well infiltrated that he knew the answer to the question before he asked it. But in any case, when George Bush did come walking through the door, Hoover very clearly recognized him as George Bush, and he certainly knew who the Bushes were because he had been the spearhead of the operation, well, let's do the counting, 20 years before Union Bank was seized as a Nazi asset. Well, if you've seized the bank as a Nazi asset, haven't you just called the chief executive officer of that bank a Nazi?
It's quite a strong connection, the fact that Bush shows up. That's just so interesting. The implications of that.
Yeah, I think that it is certainly the case that Hoover knew. Being able to know the backgrounds of politicians was Hoover's specialty. In 1963, Prescott Bush was a senator. Hoover's specialty was to have the black information on politicians in order to be able to blackmail them, in order to be able to secure his own situation and his own power. He had black information on Kennedy, he had black information on Johnson, he had black information on everybody. So he certainly would have known, and he investigated and exposed Prescott Bush as a Nazi. He would have known about Prescott and when Bush comes in and he's Prescott's son, this would be information that would be immediately, the significance of which would have been immediately clear to J. Edgar Hoover, who's writing the memo and signing it himself. And yes, of course, he's going to have to say this stuff in code.
This is where we're going to find out how Hoover's going to react to the assassination. What he writes in this memo is going to be an indication of how he's reacting to the assassination, which is something that's obviously going to be of great interest to the people who carried it out, is to see, okay, Hoover, what's your play here, dude?
You have a situation where Hoover is reporting to the CIA on the CIA's black operations.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that which generates a whole lot of, hopefully, questions, because there's so many contradictions inherent in that situation. Why would the CIA be receiving a report on their black operations from the FBI? I mean, obviously, they're going to know much more about their secret operations than the FBI is. What could possibly have created this situation? And in the video, I suggest that the CIA is testing Hoover. This is a life and death question for him. Which side are you going to come down? We're going to ask you. We had a team go and murder Kennedy. Now we want you to give us a report on that team, right? We want a report from you on anti-Castro Cubans. What's their response to the murder of the president? We want you to do an investigation and give us a report so that we know whether to kill you or not. I think that that is one way of interpreting the situation. I think that it's conceivable that another way of interpreting the situation is that Hoover knew. I think that the really, really powerful evidence suggests that Lee Harvey Oswald had been a CIA agent, that they mistreated him, that Kennedy put enormous pressure as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis almost resulting in the destruction of the world in the nuclear holocaust. When Kennedy found out that the cause of that had been these terrorist raids by the CIA against Cuba, he was furious, especially because after the Bay of Pigs invasion, he had ordered an end to all of that nonsense. Mm-hmm. They hadn't ended it. They had continued it, and they had, in fact, scaled it up. When Kennedy found out about it, and that, you know, Kennedy didn't feel that what transpired in Cuba was critical to the national security of the United States, and for the existence of the United States to have been put in jeopardy because of a few CIA people thinking that, no, this is really important, we need to do all of this stuff, really stretched Kennedy's patience. And so he was furious, and he very, very strongly directed Hoover to investigate and find out where these CIA camps were so that he could shut them down, as he swore to Nikita Khrushchev that he would do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, all of that is very, very substantive. There's no doubt about any of that, that Hoover was under intense pressure from Kennedy to locate these camps and to shut them down. We also know very, very substantive evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald had infiltrated that aspect of the CIA's operation, that he was hanging out with the leader of the chief organizer of the CIA terrorist camp at Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana, which outside Florida was, I believe, the main camp that the CIA had.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up, according to the secretary, Guy Bannister, the guy who ran it, his secretary, Delphine Roberts, I believe is her name, told the Warren Commission that she saw Oswald there. The date that she gives is a week before the place is raided and shut down by FBI agents. You have, according to everybody who was on the Warren Commission who wrote about it, that on the first day of the meeting of the Warren Commission chief law enforcement officer of the state of Texas, the attorney general of the state of Texas, contacted the Warren Commission and told them that Oswald was an FBI agent, gave his FBI number, gave his salary, in addition to which you have at least one major witness. It's probably the individual that you can point to that Oswald spent time with when he was in New Orleans. This guy thought that he was having secret meetings with the FBI. What he knew is that Oswald would walk out, stop a conversation with him, walk out, and he would watch through the window as Oswald would go up to a Studebaker and receive an envelope or hand an envelope to a guy who looked like FBI to him. People have investigated and determined that the FBI was in Dallas and was checking out Studebakers from the carpool. So all of this is corroborated that Oswald was an FBI agent who had infiltrated the CIA bases. Well, there's no reason to think that he did not continue to be an FBI operative, continuing to infiltrate the CIA operations. The CIA then recruited him. David Atlee Phillips, under the name of Maurice Bishop, recruited Oswald back into the CIA and sent him to Dallas. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that Phillips knew why he was doing it. I mean, typical of the CIA is they tell you what to do. They don't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
They recruited him to go to Dallas. I don't think there's any reason to think that Oswald was not still making regular reports to the FBI. I think I want to emphasize that he wasn't making these reports to the local FBI office. I think that Hoover understood that the FBI was thoroughly infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
But if he was trying to shut down training camps, he had to have somebody, and it could have been his number one, Clyde Tolson, but it was certainly somebody who he trusted absolutely, who went directly from Hoover to meet with Oswald in order to receive these reports. Well, these meetings continued in Dallas, it appears, because, as I mentioned, there was an FBI memo, highest level, that went to every single FBI office in the country saying that they anticipated an attempt on the president's life when he was in Dallas. Where did that information come from? Well, both Garrison and Oliver Stone speculated that that information came from Oswald, who,
mm-hmm.
according to Marita Lorenz, had infiltrated the CIA's operation in Dallas associated with the assassination, so that he was in the room with these Cuban assassins who came in from Florida to participate in the assassination. He was in the room on November 21st when these guys were being briefed and given maps and money by E. Howard Hunt.
Which makes the selection of Oswald as the patsy have a lot of other interesting implications as well.
Absolutely. Just extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know what? There were a number of things that I wanted to tie in with this and 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me hit both of those nails as quickly as I can. One is that with 9/11, you have Mohammed Atta being identified as Able Danger, and if quickly try to explain that you have the security operation, anti-terrorist security operation in the United States is called Able Warrior. Well,
yeah.
Always, if you have a system in place, you need to test that system, and the way that they test Able Warrior is that they have a companion operation, a dummy operation, right? You have to have somebody that they're going to practice against. You have to have a sparring partner.
Mm-hmm.
And the sparring partner for Able Warrior is Able Danger. And the Able Danger people are supposed to simulate terrorists. They are Arabs, and they carry around backpacks full of explosives, and they carry them into subways in London, and they carry them into trains in Madrid, and they carry them onto planes in the United States. And they are supposed to be testing Able Warrior's ability to detect them and to stop them. They are not supposed to have live ammunition or live explosives or live anything. They're supposed to be dummy backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the whole sense of it. Well, I think that Oswald was doubtless told that he was the sparring partner for the Secret Service, that these guys were pretending to carry out an assassination attempt, and that the Secret Service was supposed to intercept them and stop them. But that, you know, this was in no way a plan to assassinate the president. That this was, and given all of the evidence suggesting that Oswald was a real patriot, that he was, you know, a devoted and loyal American who was trying to serve the interests of the best interests of the and legal interests of the United States and the will of the president and so on, I find it hard to believe that he would have been recruited to anything else. But I expect that that's what they would have told him.
I would accept that's a pretty good explanation for what might have been going on there, in terms of Oswald thinking that this wasn't really a legit hit.
Oswald was recruited by the CIA to go to Russia. Now, the life expectancy of CIA agents sent to Russia is I believe it's about zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the U.S. sent just an extraordinary number of agents immediately after World War II ended into the Soviet Union, and I don't believe any of them survived. It certainly, that's the impression that you get when you read very, very knowledgeable pieces of work on the topic. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously this is a volunteer operation, and Oswald volunteered for it. And he went off, and what could he possibly have been expecting in terms of personal gain by doing this? But he took the job, and he went off. And, you know, I don't know if you want to go into that. It's a very, very interesting and, I think, important piece of information. What was going on is that the CIA was planning to shoot down the U-2 or to blow it up.
Mm-hmm.
Eisenhower was trying to cool off the Cold War. The Cold War was entirely a hoax. The Russians had no intention of invading Western Europe, and the CIA knew it, but they put forward the story that they thought that the Russians posed this threat and that therefore we needed to build up our military and get ready for a war with Russia. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on. The CIA knew, they observed that the Russians were not rebuilding the railroads connecting Eastern Germany to Russia. And if you're going to have, you know, a major military operation, you have to solve your logistical problems involved in that. And they weren't addressing any logistical problems that would have been involved in an invasion. So it was very, very clear to the CIA that the Russians were not involved in this. But the Cold War is essential to the military-industrial complex. It was essential to the McCarthy attacks upon the left wing in this country, and mm-hmm. that might be as much the essence of it as anything. But Eisenhower looked at the situation, and he wasn't an idiot, and he looked at it, and he said, no, this is all unnecessary. I want to meet with the Russian leaders, and I want to resolve that. We're wasting billions and billions of dollars that we could be spending on education, that we could be spending on improving the lives of people, providing health care, and on, we're wasting it on this Cold War. Literally, I mean, Eisenhower gave a speech in which he said all of those things in so many words, and so he wanted to try to cool off the Cold War. He arranged to meet with Khrushchev, and these guys said, well, how are we going to shoot this down? Let's have the U-2. Let's let the Russians find out about the U-2. Eisenhower ordered the U-2 flight suspended. The CIA sent in a U-2 anyhow. Gary Powers, the pilot of the plane, said that he thought there was a bomb on the plane and that it exploded. But they told Eisenhower that the plane had been shot down. Well, that would have been a difficult thing for Eisenhower to believe, because the plane flew absolutely so high mm-hmm. that there was no way that the Russians could have detected it unless they had been tipped off. And Oswald was a U-2 radar operator. And if the U.S. was retarded and Oswald defected and they didn't take any steps to accommodate that notion, Oswald could have given them information about how to locate a U-2 when it was flying over. Oswald thought that he was going into the Soviet Union to be 007 and to try to, you know, spy and find out stuff and supply the U.S. with information about what was going on inside the Soviet Union. The only thing the CIA was interested was in getting his butt over there so that they could then use him as the cover mm-hmm. for them blowing up the U-2 and then claiming that the Russians shot it down. So Oswald arrives in Russia. He's expecting to be contacted secretly and constantly by the CIA to get reports, and he's never contacted because they're not interested in him. Once he was there, they were in no way interested in him. So on his own, he initiates his own return, and when he returns, he's treated very, very shabbily, and they get him a minimum wage job, but with a security clearance and with CIA contacts, they arrange for him to have the job. So he's still very clearly persona grata to the CIA, but they mm-hmm. they treat him as shabbily as they treated him when they sent him over in the first place, which was why I think the FBI was able to recruit him.
I'm telling you, you know, the implications of all of this, they trail back into the whole confrontation between East and West, alleged. All of this stuff in relation to Kennedy, in order to understand it, you have to be able to understand the bigger context it's taking place in, and that takes you into the roots of World War II and why it happened, and it really explains modern history. because you end up understanding what's going on.
You know, it's like an X-ray.
Mm.
And I wouldn't say that an X-ray explains very much, but it does give you something substantive. One of the major pieces that I have been working on in the last year or so is the really, really establishable fact that Adolf Hitler was an agent, that he was totally a creation. That he, in fact, in his background was the opposite of anti-Semitic. If you were, you know, to try to look closely at his background, that all of the influences were not towards anti-Semitism. They were in a very, very different direction. He had very, very good relations with Jewish professionals, but I don't want to go way off and down that path. How far back does this stuff go? And it goes back way beyond Hitler.
You look at what's going on now, and we say how terrible, and it is terrible what's going on in Iraq, and the number of people killed is terrible. But this is just a sideshow compared to some of the parties these people have run, like World War II, which they ran. They ran it. They made it. They created it. They destroyed Europe with it. They ensured the economic success of the United States and of Great Britain with it. These guys were playing geopolitics.
70 million white people. They killed 70 million white people. To get back to this X-ray business, I have something to share with you. At least I used to be very open to the notion that the Rothschilds were probably the main financial force in the world today. They are certainly absolutely indispensable players in the Holocaust, and demonstrably, right, in black and white, just the most outrageous information is readily at hand, and just nobody knows about it because the media doesn't talk about it, but in absolutely facilitating the Holocaust, and facilitating might not be a strong enough word.
Yep.
Right? Collaboration is
a better word, yeah.
A strong enough word. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, the point is that I thought that the Rothschilds were very, very major players, and I guess I don't have any particular reason to think otherwise, but certainly the Harrimans and the DuPonts and the Morgans and the Gettys and the Rockefellers are also very, very, very major players. And then you have the Windsors and, you know, that whole load of crap in England. Anyway, Royal Dutch Shell and all of those scumbags.
As well,
but,
yeah.
I was always under the impression that the Rothschilds were very, very, very major players. And I believe that it was in 1997 that the head of the Rothschild family, I've got to insert a pause here. You want to understand, when we say the head of the Rothschild family, exactly what we mean. The Rothschild family is set up so that the firstborn son inherits everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the founder of the Rothschild family understood that if you dissipate the fortune among all of the children, that you then weaken the power that you're trying to establish, and so if the fortune is not inherited and dissipated by being distributed among the children, the vast lion's share of the fortune always falls into the hands of the firstborn sons. But when you say the head of the Rothschild family, you're meaning something different than when you say the head of the Rockefeller family, which is figurative. And when you say the head of the Rothschild family, it is a literal expression.
Yeah.
This guy is genuinely... Okay, and in 1997, he was suicided. He didn't get two shots in the head, but he was found... Right, he didn't commit suicide by shooting himself in the head twice, which... has happened recently to important figures in the United States.
Yeah.
But he was found, the official report is that he hung himself with the belt to his bathrobe by tying it to the towel rack in his bathroom, which was pulled out of the wall, right? They found him strangled on the bathroom floor. The towel rack is pulled out of the wall, and he has his belt wrapped around his throat, and he's been strangled. This is 1997. This is a totally lead-up to... September 11th. I think to me the inescapable conclusion is that this guy, they put to him the plan of September 11th, which was we're going to instigate a cultural war between the Muslim world. The Muslims are going to become the new communists.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to become the new anarchists. They're going to be the new boogeyman to justify the domination of the military-industrial complex and the national security state. Mm-hmm. And this guy apparently didn't go along with it. I can't imagine any other reason for taking him out, but he was taken out. So that if the head of the Rothschild family has been murdered, you can't hope to determine what is genuinely going on, right? I mean, the most that you can hope for is you can look at the some particulars of 9/11, and you can look at some particulars of the Kennedy assassination, and you can get little glimpses of how these guys work.
Mm-hmm.
But you can never hope to, I don't think, completely understand how these guys work, and I don't really suggest that it's necessary to do that. I think we just need to, you know, dismantle the banks and dismantle the banking system and have every government issue their own currency and be in charge of their own currency, and we solve the problem, at least to a very, very large extent. I think we will have broken the backs of this conglomerate that foisted World War II and the Holocaust on us, but that would be a major step.
It would be a good place to start, yeah. But at least, John,
yes,
at
yes.
least, even though we are not getting all of the pieces of the puzzle, at least we're dealing with some real goddamn history for a change, which is a bit refreshing.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know?
That's right. We're getting a glimpse.
Yeah.
We're getting a glimpse of something besides the shadow on the wall.
I think it's great the kind of discipline that you've brought to your examination of the issues, John. And I also know that we've taken a lot of your time, and I'm very grateful to you for giving us that time. And I think that people who listen to this are going to have to take time to take it on board, go and watch the videos, get the videos, buy them, start spreading the word around, because I think that the JFK junior and senior issues, really, they highlight so much of the underlying network of all this stuff that they're great places to start to understand what's really going on. John Hankey, thank you very much for joining us today.
Terribly grateful for you having me on. If I'm going to get a parting shot, I would say that people absolutely have to understand the critical importance of the role that they play, that you cannot possibly underestimate the importance of people, word of mouth, turning to the person next to them and saying, here, have you seen this? So please buy my DVD and then please make copies of it and please distribute it for free to everybody that you can, you know, to your mama and your brother and your sister and your uncle and the guy on the bus. It's mm-hmm. absolutely critical.
Yeah.
And thank you, Fenton, for your wonderful work and for having me on. And God bless you and everybody you happen to have listening to you.
Well, I tell you, we got a lot of switched on, tuned in people who are on the Break for News forum. And they're well capable of understanding the implications of what you've been researching. And then beyond that, it is important, as you say, for others to at least start the regular Joe off down the pathway of understanding the labyrinth that this is behind the scenes by your two videos. And I'd encourage people to go and buy them and get a few books your way. Thanks again, John. Look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you so much.
Okay, my thanks to John for all of that. That's just outstanding. And remember, the website is jfk2.com, that's jfkii.com for John Hankey's website, where you can get both of those videos on DVD. And also you can use the web URL, which I prefer, bushkilledjfk.com. I like that one because it can apply twice. Quite an interesting proposal, isn't it? And in summarizing what we covered in the last discussion with John, I felt, and I think he feels too, that we don't have indictable evidence to hang it on Junior, but there are a lot of good reasons to think that he may well have been blooded by being involved in that prior to taking on the presidency. But in relation to George Bush Senior, there is incredible evidence there of George Bush Senior's involvement. Now, you can also find on breakfornews.com in our 9/11 section of the forum a lot of other stuff about George Bush Sr. and our assertion that he has been in de facto control of the United States since he came to power with Reagan, effectively, and that the Clinton presidency was and is, as Clinton is, run by either Bush or the same people who are running Bush behind the scenes. These are some of the questions that we have to address in terms of establishing how much of the power resides within the Bush family and how much of the power resides elsewhere, and if so, where. So I look forward to forum members' responses to both of these interviews with John Hankey, because I know we've got a lot of very acute observers of these issues in the forum. So please do contribute your views. And maybe we will return to take some kind of a look at the overall issue of the Bushes and who's behind them in relation to all of these events, including 9/11. Okay, thank you for your interest, your enthusiasm, and your participation in breakfornews.com. I will be back soon with more. But in the meantime, for breakfornews.com, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting. Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle bright for me. Will you always keep me warm? Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle bright for me. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun.